Mike Harvke is a native of Missouri, a graduate fellow of Columbia University's Creative Writing MFA program, published in numerous literary magazines. From 2010 to 2013, Mike was a reviews editor at Publishers Weekly and a contributing writer to several others. Right now, Mike is on tour promoting his debut novel, In the Course of Human Events, and he will be reading in Kalamazoo on August 21st at 7 p.m. at Book Bug on Oakland Drive. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Mike, can you describe your novel in a nutshell for our listeners?
Sure. In the Course of Human Events is about a young Midwestern man who, by the ripe age of 20, has all but given up hope for the future. He's living in the shadow of the economic collapse and doesn't even realize how angry he is until he meets Jay Smalls, a charismatic and powerful and very seductive karate teacher. Jay takes Clyde under his wing to give him a little bit of confidence and power, but Jay's teachings have a darker side to them, and fairly soon we witness the total indoctrination of this young man into radical anti-government extremism.
I understand you've put some of your own experience into this novel, and what author doesn't, that you're a black belt, that you've got some friends in the militia.
Yeah. I mean, starting with my friends, I grew up in a small town in northwest Missouri and did have people that I knew slip into militia from one time or another. But actually, one of my closest friends, one day when we were hanging out, started telling me about a book that he'd read that had made a very big impact on him. Mm-hmm. And he told me what it warned of, which was pending repeal of the Second Amendment, raids on honest gun owners' homes, and barcode tattoos that every American citizen was soon going to be forced to get for tracking purposes. And this book, I didn't know at the time, it was called Behold a Pale Horse, and is a book that's beloved in the Patriot movement, especially among the conspiracy-minded faction of that. And my friend really fell for it, and that conversation ended with him actually whipping out his new handgun and pointing off behind my head and saying, when that ATF agent shows up at my door, he's going to get a big surprise.
Whoa.
It was frightening,
yeah,
to say the least. And it sparked my interest in how a book or a pamphlet or anything like that could begin to open the door into extremism. And so that led me to start doing a lot of research into the Patriot movement. And that research happened to coincide with the economic collapse, and that those two things, you know, sort of created, you know, they coalesced into this book.
Any of these friends that were involved with the militia, have they read the book? Any feedback from them on what they think of it?
No feedback. And I sent my main friend who did end up in the militia, and luckily, he got out of the militia and sort of returned to normal life. But there was a time when he was spending a lot of his afternoons standing around in field, shaking his fist at the government and amassing a minor stockpile of weapons, so much so that the FBI took note. Hmm. But he got out of it and returned to normal and has the book, but I've not heard a reaction yet.
Hmm.
I'd be curious to know.
Yeah, I would too. Your book has also been compared to Fight Club. I imagine a lot of our listeners have at least seen the movie with Brad Pitt. And
yeah,
usually positively so, that you're the better of the two. How do you feel about that comparison?
I mean, that was certainly nice to hear. I don't want to pick a fight with Chuck Palahniuk, but I love Fight Club and the book and the film. Brad Pitt, fellow Missourian, so you know, that resonated particularly with me. I think that the books are quite different in the way that the narratives unfold, and there are times, of course, when I think I wish I had a written Fight Club. You know, I wish that you know, because some of the way that Polaniuk does handle the economic situation is really appealing to me, and I sometimes think about writing a contemporary book. I mean, my book is contemporary, of course, but it's so rooted in its Midwestern sort of rural landscape, and I have lived in cities now for 25 years, and think that there's a lot of material there.
Now, it your main character, Clyde Twitty, and I love that name, by the way, losing everything, losing his work, being just brought down to that bottom level, is the way he's changed, and Jay being a conduit to that change. Are human beings, do you think, basically made to want control? Is having control the key to happiness or maybe even sanity?
I think so, yeah. I think that we want either to be controlled or to control. And I think that a lot of times the easier path is to be controlled because you have everything taken care of. You're taken
That's
care of.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
You're taken care of, your needs are taken care of, and you're told what to do and when to do it and what not to do. And I have, as you mentioned, I have a black belt in Kyokushin karate, and when I was a teenager, I also trained Shotokan, a basic form of Japanese martial arts, in Missouri. And karate was everywhere when I was growing up. You know, it's really big in the Midwest, and especially in the 80s. I think the Karate Kid probably has something to answer for there. Mm-hmm. But I saw even then as a teenager how a practice, a form of practice like martial arts, can be used at its worst to completely control and direct the individual toward the teacher's own ideologies and interests.
Mm. You've been working on this book a long time, since 2006, I believe, and it's not like you're a laid-back writer. I understand you wrote 4 or 5 hours a day, even while working.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty intense.
Yeah, it is intense. The idea came to me in 2006, and I sort of started in earnest in 2007. At that time, I was lucky for work. I was able to freelance in a fairly high-paying field, graphic design.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were years in 2005, 6, and 7 when I really only worked about 8 months of the year. When I worked, I was working all out, 12-hour days, sometimes all night long. But when I didn't work, all I did was write. And that was when I wrote the first drafts of this novel. And there were times when I would finish a draft and set it aside for really a full year. I had no idea when I started writing this book what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a good 3 or 4 drafts for the actual story to emerge. And then the economic collapse happened, which sent me scrambling after other work because the advertising and graphic design industries were very quickly and hardly hit. So I had to change careers, and that's when, in 2010, I got my first full-time job in a decade.
Mm-hmm.
9 to 5, working at Publishers Weekly. And what seemed at first to me like it was going to kill my writing life actually was, in a way, something that saved it, because even though I had very little time, I had very small windows on a daily basis in which to write, it taught me so much about the business of publishing. And it also made me realize that a small window can force you to get just as much done, you know, if you have five or six hours a day to write. So in 2 hours, I could actually write 20 pages.
That's interesting. With a novel set in rural Missouri, do you think that people experience the economic collapse, terrorism, 9/11, that kind of a thing? Do you think they experienced it differently in any way than people than in, say, New York or D.C. or Chicago?
I do think that they experienced it differently. I know that I was in New York when 9/11 happened, and had my own experience of that, which seemed, of course, terrifying and very close, even though I was uptown, and that hill between uptown and downtown kept what had happened actually out of view. But just being outside, being in New York at that time was an intense experience. But my family in Missouri had just as an intense experience of 9/11, and they just sort of metastasized it in a different way. And I think that the economic collapse is similar. I was in New York for that, and family and friends in rural areas in Missouri and elsewhere. And I think that being in a city like New York, as hard as it can be and harsh, it also has a lot of opportunity. Places like rural Missouri, there's very little opportunity. And when a factory closes down, that opportunity goes away to a frightening extent.
Mm. So define freedom, Mike, for Clyde Twitty, for you, for America. Have we lost it? Is it about having choices, about having control? How do we get it back?
It's a good question. I think freedom is one of those words, like genius, that is thrown around a lot and understood very little. And I don't claim to have any grand understanding of it. I have my own take on the word, and for me, it is an idea that is slipping away, because for me, freedom means having time to pursue whatever interests you want to do. It's the time that you're not working for somebody else. All of us have to work. This is the system that we choose to be involved in or we're born into. And it's an important system. It's but it's not all there is. And I think that a generation ago, people had more time to spend with their families, or to go fishing, or to read, or do whatever it was that they wanted to do. Thomas Jefferson, at the end of every day, used to sit for 1 hour in a chair and reflect on his day. That idea seems completely antiquated at this point. And it's not, part of it is stuff that we think we want. Part of the reason we can't spend or don't spend that hour reflecting on our day is because we have iPhones and iPads and television and cable and internet and all of those other things that are demanding our attention. But there's, to me, a sad and sort of dark side behind that, which is that advertisers and content providers have been working very hard over the last couple of decades to figure out ways to snag the consumer during those moments of quiet and those downtime moments that we used to have, where we would simply sit with our thoughts.
Yeah, I hear you. I love the name of the town, by the way, Lick Skillet. Is there a story behind Lick Skillet, the name?
There is actually, and it is a town in Missouri near where I grew up. It's nothing like the Lickskillet in my book, but it's an area near another great name, which is Knob Noster, where, you know, 150 years ago, a woman set out her frying pan on the stoop, and a dog came along in the night to lick at the grease, and its tongue froze to the pan, and that gave the place its name.
Poor puppy. You've been on tour with your friend and author, Josh Weil, who will also be reading at Book Bug along with you. But your books are both from different publishers. How did this co-tour come about?
It was just our idea, actually. More and more these days, publishers are uninterested in the authors doing major book tours, unless they're very well known. Josh is, with this being his second book, is more well known than I am. But, you know, Josh took all of this on himself, and he's doing a much bigger tour as well. So he'll have driven back and forth across the country twice. I'm going to be with him on one leg of that, which is from the East Coast to the West Coast in a little bit here. But it's just our idea. It was the idea to spend some quality time together, which is, you know, he lives on the West Coast, I live on the East Coast. We used to live in the same city for a decade, and so it's actually really attractive to be able to spend that much time in a car or camping or hiking, and we're going to fit those kind of things in around readings and signings and things like that. But it's also a great way to get to know bookstores and booksellers in communities that I might otherwise not, get to reach personally.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, too. What are you discovering on tour? What kind of feedback are you getting from your audiences?
It's great, actually. It's kind of, on tour is when it becomes kind of real that your book is out there. It's easy, actually, to, you've written a book and you've got all this mechanism that sends it out into the world, into bookstores, and hopefully into readers' hands, but it's all abstract. You can, as an author, look at your sales numbers and all of that. I don't do that. I don't want to know. But when you're standing in a bookstore and you're seeing people in the audience who, you know, you're having this communion with, really, that's when the book being out there in the world becomes real to you as an author. And when somebody comes up and they talk to you about it, they say, they ask you a question, or they tell you, a scene that they particularly liked or whatever, or even have, criticism, it's all great because you know that there's a reader standing in front of you who's engaging with you about this thing that you've spent so much time working on and trying to perfect.
Well, it's a terrific book, and congratulations on its publication, and we're looking forward to hearing and seeing you at Book Bug. If you could read us a short excerpt just to tantalize us a little bit, we'd love to hear it.
Of course. I'll read a moment from about midway in the book when Jay has told Clyde that it's time he cut ties entirely with his family, and Jay has driven him over to his Uncle Willie's house to do this. His Uncle Willie, of course, is not taking this too kindly. "All Jay's done is opened my eyes to the way the world really is," Clyde said. Willie leaned on his cane. "How's that, then, the way it really is?" "Zog," Clyde said. "What?" "Zog. The Zionist Occupational Government," Clyde said. "Zog. What's that? I don't know what that is." "Nobody outside the movement does," Clyde said. "The movement," Willie said. "The patriot movement, the resistance, Clyde said. Since the creation of Israel, Uncle Willie, no matter who's elected president every 4 years in Washington, it's a secret group of Jews who really run the country, the world, because the UN and the U.S. and the Eurozone are all in it together. Zog is powerful, wealthy, and the American people are nothing but puppets working themselves half to death to fund Zog's interests, which are, Clyde used his fingers to tick them off, military-industrial, which leads to profits, which leads to economic disparity, which leads to global unrest, which leads to terrorism, which makes it easy for them to take away our rights, attack the Constitution, repeal the Second Amendment, and that's just what's happening today. Don't get me started on what they've got planned for the future. Clyde shook his head, but he wasn't looking at Willie. One thing I know now without a doubt, Uncle Willie, and I wish I'd known this a long time ago, and I hate to say this to you because you work hard and don't ever complain, but the greatest lie, the greatest joke, really, that's been played on the working people of this nation is the American dream.
Thank you, Mike. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Zinta. It's been great.